American Free Press Audio Edition, Issue 49 and 50, December 2 and 9, 2019. Whistleblowers say Syria was framed for poison gas attack. Vital information that would have exonerated Syrian government was purposely suppressed. By John Friend, an inspector with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, an international organization that has investigated the alleged use of chemical weapons by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime, has recently come forward claiming that key evidence was suppressed by senior management at the organization that would have exonerated the Syrian government over claims its military had used chemical weapons to brutally attack its own helpless citizens, neocon warmongers in the U.S. and other Western nations, including France and the United Kingdom, have long alleged that Assad's government has systematically targeted civilians with chemical weapons in the civil war that has wreaked havoc on the Arab country. Opposition forces hostile to Assad have been supported and funded by Western states and the Israelis in order to destabilize and ultimately overthrow the once stable government. Allegations that Assad's forces have utilized chemical weapons in the war have largely been manufactured by the West and the mass media, with international organizations such as the OPCW providing cover, despite their own internal investigators' findings casting doubt on such allegations. The inspector, who is using the pseudonym Alex so as not to reveal his identity, recently came forward after failing to internally resolve the dispute with management at OPCW. Most of the DOMA team felt the two reports on the incident, the interim report and the final report, were scientifically impoverished, procedurally irregular, and possibly fraudulent, Alex told several reporters in Europe. DOMA refers to the city in Syria where the alleged chemical attack took place. Alex hopes that the internal investigators involved with scientifically investigating the scenes, analyzing evidence, and drafting the original reports will be able to address the upcoming OPCW annual conference, which brings together representatives of the various member states comprising the OPCW, allowing the investigators, such as himself, to address the conference and answer questions would demonstrate transparency, impartiality and independence, which clearly have been lacking at the organization. Alex is not the first whistleblower at OPCW to come forward with allegations that senior management has suppressed information damaging to claims that the Syrian regime used chemical weapons. Ian Henderson, a South African ballistics expert, led a team that examined two cylinders that forces hostile to Assad alleged were dropped from helicopters on areas occupied by rebels. The cylinders were said to have been filled with chlorine gas. After assessing the situation, Henderson's team overwhelmingly viewed the cylinders as having been staged by the rebel forces themselves in an effort to indict the Syrian government, which Assad and his backers have long claimed. Henderson's findings were omitted in later reports on the investigation. Ian and I wanted to have this issue investigated and hopefully resolved internally, rather than exposing the failings of the organization in public. So we exhausted every internal avenue possible, including submission of all the evidence of irregular behavior to the Office of Internal Oversight, Alex recently stated after going public. The request for an internal investigation was refused and every other attempt to raise our concerns was stonewalled. Our failed efforts to get management to listen went on over a period of nearly 9 months. It was only after we realized the internal route was impossible that we decided to go public. Evidence indicating that chemical weapons were not in fact used by Assad's forces was systematically suppressed by OPCW in subsequent reports, essentially contradicting the findings of objective scientific experts and investigators. The doctored findings of the OPCW were used, at least in part, to justify military strikes on Syrian targets and to demonize Assad in the international press. Damning evidence against Trump is non-existent. If we were to start handing out awards to the big media for dumbest headline related to the Democrats' recent impeachment hearings, the prize would probably go to USA Today's November 21 report, titled "Sondland Dropped Bombs While Also Defusing Them." Not to be outdone, the runners-up included MSNBC's breathless report, "It's a Bombshell, Shakedown Witness Confirms Damning Impeachment Call," The Philadelphia Inquirer's impeachment inquiry proved America can't be saved from a cult called the GOP, and, last but by no means least, Slate Magazine's There's Really No Reason Not to Impeach Trump. Ironically, when we discussed the week's hearings during a recent editorial meeting, we felt a bit like Donald Trump back when he was hosting the Miss USA pageants, standing in front of a stage full of great contenders. We had to pick just one winner among many doozies. With words in these headlines like bombshell, cover-up, and crime, you'd actually think that one of the half-dozen key witnesses who testified during California Rep. Adam Schiff's hearings actually said something that would lead to the impeachment of President Trump. But now that the hearings are, for the most part, over, and the Democrats are frantically ginning up their own version of what happened in a report, we can't help but feel what so many other objective Americans are thinking right now. Democrats sold America the sizzle and the steak, but, when it came time to deliver the goods, all we got was an overcooked rump roast. If all you read and watched were big media, you'd think that key witnesses like Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland, National Security Council member Lieutenant Col. Alexander Vindman, former Ambassador to Ukraine Marielle Ivano, Vich, Acting Ukraine Ambassador William B. Taylor Jr., or National Security Council member Fiona Hill had damning evidence that Trump withheld aid to Ukraine in order to force that country's leadership to investigate a political rival. If you listened to the full hearings, however, you'd walk away with a completely different impression, as we did. Take for example Sondland's testimony. Democrat Party allies in the mainstream media puffed him up to their audiences, claiming that he had first-hand knowledge of Trump's purported quid pro quo, and, in his opening statements, Sondland so much has stated this, telling the world that everyone in the Trump administration knew what Trump was doing. In the last few minutes of Sondland's testimony, however, his claim was destroyed by Rep. Michael Turner, R. Ohio, who actually stopped to ask Sondland if he ever heard the president say any of this. We are publishing a portion of that embarrassing exchange, because, God knows, no one else in the big media ever will. So, no one told you, said Turner in questioning Sondland. Not just the president. Giuliani didn't tell you, Mulvaney didn't tell you, nobody, Pompeo didn't tell you, nobody else on this planet told you that Donald Trump was tying aid to these investigations? Is it correct? I think I already testified to that, Sondland said. No, answer the question. Is it correct? Retorted Turner. No one on this planet told you that Donald Trump was tying this aid to the investigation? Because if your answer is yes, then the chairman's wrong and the headline on CNN is wrong. No one on this planet told you that President Trump was tying aid to investigations? Yes or no? Yes, said Sondland. So, you really have no testimony that ties President Trump to a scheme to withhold aid from Ukraine in exchange for these investigations? Asked Turner. Other than my own presumption, said Sondland. Which is nothing, concluded Turner. And then there was the Democrat star witness Taylor. In less than 2 minutes, Rep. Jim Jordan, R. Ohio, shredded Taylor's testimony, tearing into him regarding claims that there was a linkage between withholding of the funds and a public announcement of an Ukraine investigation into Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. Three meetings, face-to-face, with Ukrainian President Zelensky. No linkage, Jordan said to Taylor. Yet, in your deposition, you said this, and you said it again the first hour. My clear understanding was security assistance money would not come until President Zelensky committed to pursue the investigation. So I'm wondering, where did you get this clear understanding? President Zelensky never made an announcement. Taylor conceded to Jordan he had gotten his clear understanding from Sondland, who, as we previously noted, had never heard the president's or anyone else voice the need for tying aid to the investigation. Jordan then cited a clarification issued by Taylor earlier that week that sought to clear up where Taylor overheard Trump's purported demand for a quid pro quo. Here is what Taylor said in that clarification. According to Jordan, Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I had conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. For effect, Jordan read it again, even slowing down his words so we all could let it sink in. We got six people having four conversations in one sentence, and you just told me this is where you got your clear understanding, Jordan added, and you're their star witness. All joking aside, this is an important matter. Read our special reports by Dr. Ron Paul and Donald Jeffries on pages 12 and 13 in this week's important issue to get even more details on why impeaching Trump is perhaps even dumber than the entirety of last year's Russiagate collusion conspiracy theory. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor. Jeffrey Epstein's elite clientele. Prince Andrew gives suspicious interview about connections to pedophile. By St. Patrick. In trying to get ahead of the scandal regarding his relationship with the suicided Jeffrey Epstein, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, may have caused an even bigger public relations disaster for the Windsors, Great Britain's royal family. In an interview with Emily Maitlis of BBC Newsnight, Prince Andrew hyperactively blinked, twitched, stuttered, and stammered his way through an uncomfortable series of questions, all making him look even more guilty. Not his intention when he agreed to the interview, to be sure. Taking the interview, alone, was an unpopular decision among his own advisors. The Duke's own director of public relations, Jason Stein, resigned over the mere fact that Andrew had agreed to the interview with the BBC. Prince Andrew's link to Epstein is problematic enough, but recent denials that he even knew accuser Virginia Roberts Jeffrey is what currently has him in boiling water. Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, is the second son of Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. In 1986, Andrew married Sarah Ferguson. They divorced in 1996, having been officially separated for 4 years. Andrew's role within the state was a rather important one, serving as Britain's special representative for international trade and investment. His friendship with financier Jeffrey Epstein was first reported in 2011. Though they'd been photographed together in 2010, Andrew had asked Epstein to help Ferguson, the Duchess of York, pay off some lingering debt problems. The relationship was already causing issues within Buckingham Palace. Epstein had been jailed in 2008 for soliciting young girls for underage prostitution. If a royal needed a financial advisor to assist an ex-wife with debt, Epstein seems an odd call to make unless there was already an established relationship. In an amazingly self-aggrandizing moment, Andrew explained to the BBC's Maitlis the motive behind staying at Epstein's mansion after knowing Epstein was a convicted sex offender. At the time I felt it was the honorable and right thing to do, Andrew explained nervously, and I admit fully that my judgment was probably colored by my tendency to be too honorable, but that's just the way it is. The interview turned to the topic of Jeffrey, who claimed she had sex with Andrew when she was 17 years old. I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady, none whatsoever, Andrew said, surprised. Maitlis re-asked the question, you don't remember meeting her? No, Prince Andrew said. Much has been made of Andrew's nervous blinking during this exchange. He blinked at least 10 times in the 10-second exchange. According to a 2014 Psychology Today article on the link between blink rates and lying, Jack Schaefer, Ph.D., wrote, liars tend to blink more because lying is stressful. Under stress, eye blink rate increases. People tend to blink more rapidly when they become nervous or when they hear or see something unpleasant. Andrew chalked up Jeffrey's description of him profusely sweating by stating that he could not sweat at the time because of an overdose of adrenaline that occurred in the 1982 Falklands War when he had been shot at. About the infamous picture with his arms around Jeffrey's waist in London, Andrew claimed it couldn't have been London because he wasn't wearing a tie. Those were his traveling clothes, his attire for going overseas. Asked if he believed the photo was tampered with, he said, nobody can prove whether or not that photograph has been doctored, but I don't recollect that photograph ever being taken. Jeffrey told Dateline NBC that she was forced to engage in sexual acts with Prince Andrew after she was given vodka by him in a London nightclub. The acts took place at the home of Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's procurer-in-chief. Jeffrey described Andrew's demeanor. He was not rude or anything about it. He said thank you in some kind of soft sentiments like that and left, she said. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that even royalty were involved. She said that sex acts with Andrew took place two more times after the instance in London, once at Epstein's New York mansion and another time at his Virgin Islands estate, commonly known now as Pedophile Island. Buckingham Palace has denied all accusations to CNN, stating, "It is emphatically denied that the Duke of York had any form of sexual contact or relationship with Virginia Roberts. Any claim to the contrary is false and without foundation." Responding to the official denials, Giuffre said, "He denies that it ever happened and he's going to keep denying that it ever happened, but he knows the truth and I know the truth." Who's in Jeffrey Epstein's Little Black Book? By Mark Anderson. What may be an actual unredacted copy of Jeffrey Epstein's infamous Little Black Book contains the names of certain recognizable elites from the Bilderberg CFR trilateral banking axis, among other well-known people, several blogs and online news outlets, including the St. Louis Times, are treating the list, which sports 92 pages and is labeled with the years 2004 to 2005, as authentic. Though it may only be one of many of Epstein's Little Black Books, but the names listed intimate that Epstein walked in elite circles. Any person's inclusion on the list does not confirm, nor are we implying it confirms, that the person listed took place in any illicit activities at Epstein's getaway island or anywhere else. The book is purely a list of names up to about page 60. Thereafter, it's largely places, hotels, rental car outlets, eateries, airports, taxi services, massage parlors, law firms, real estate offices, etc., with additional names sprinkled in. Even the general public information line of the White House is listed. Interestingly, most of the names of these movers and shakers have their often hyper-private phone numbers and their email addresses listed as well, though most of those likely have been changed. Several physical addresses are included from that time. The most prominent members revealed by a scan of the list include Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, Conrad Black, Michael Bloomberg, Tony Blair, Henry Kravis, former senator, George Mitchell, former senator, John Kerry, Skull and Bones, Yale, John Micklethwaite, Edgar Bronfman, J.R. Walter Isaacson, Rupert Murdoch, Evelyn Rothschild. Other prominent notables: Jeffrey Sachs, Peter Mandelson, Peter Soros, John Huntsman, David Koch, Bill Richardson, Rob Rosenstein, Ira Magaziner, Senator Edward Kennedy, Bobby and Mary Kennedy, Ethel Kennedy, Eli Wiesel, Richard Branson, Stephen Sabine, Forbes, the Duchess and Duke of York, Alan Dershowitz, Donald J. Trump, Ehud Olmert, Ehud Barak, Thomas and Nick Pritzker. Pritzker family supports Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Some others of interest: Kevin Spacey, Mick Jagger, Jimmy Buffett and Jane, Alec Baldwin, Sir David Frost, Phil Collins, and Orion, John Cleese, and Alice Faye, Dustin Hoffman, Bobby and Maria Shriver, Joan Rivers, Mike Wallace, Barbara Walters, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, Courtney Love, Lauren Hutton, Liz Hurley, Itzhak Perlman, Angie Everhart, Naomi Campbell, Mark Getty. Probably 80 of the pages average 5 names per page of individuals, making the list about 400 names. Bill Clinton's name was not listed. A Failed Legacy of Regime Change, by S.T. Patrick. As citizens of nations around the world line the streets as far as the eye can see in protest of tyrannical governments, many linked to U.S. corporations, financial institutions, and politicians, it is worth remembering the flawed call to arms of President Woodrow Wilson on April 2, 1917. Wilson used the threat of German domination and a Mexican invasion, via the Zimmerman telegram, to ask Congress for a declaration of war. America must intervene in affairs, Wilson argued, so that the world can be made safe for democracy. Its peace must be planted upon the tested foundations of political liberty. Wilson's plea continued, "We have no selfish ends to serve. We desire no conquest, no dominion. We seek no indemnities for ourselves, no material compensation for the sacrifices we shall freely make. We are but one of the champions of the rights of mankind. We shall be satisfied when those rights have been made as secure as the faith in the freedom of nations can make them." Yet, when World War I ended and the victors met at Versailles, the world was carved up to meet the aims of the U.S., Great Britain, France, and Italy. The U.S. and Great Britain had their eyes particularly turned to the Middle East, and for the next 100 years, American foreign policy has operated on serving its selfish ends. The aftermath of World War II ushered in another carving up of sovereign nations, this time with the rise of the U.S. intelligence community on its heels. President Harry S. Truman created the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, through the National Security Act in 1947, the beginning of what would be a 50-year Cold War. Speaking to biographer Merle Miller toward the end of his life, in the 1960s, Truman would express regret about the agency's creation. "I think it was a mistake," Truman told Miller, "and if I'd known what was going to happen, I never would have done it." Truman said this well before the Church Committee hearings of 1975 to 1976 had outed many of the CIA's dirtiest deeds, including the internal report entitled The Family Jewels. What was going to happen, in Truman's words, was best described in the book Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II by the late William Bloom. It is the primer on American-led and American-financed coup d'états. Bloom's 2004 edition lists 55 separate chapters, one per coup. The 56th and final chapter combines all coups between 1992 and 2004. A coup is technically a sudden, violent, and illegal seizure of power from a government. Those are hard coups. There are also soft coups, silent coups, that seize power strategically, nonviolently, and from within. President Richard Nixon's downfall was spurred by a silent coup, and it's likely that President Donald Trump is increasingly falling victim to one today. But abroad, where the media leaking back to Americans is also controlled by the Pentagon and CIA, hard coups are less risky. The media's painting of foreign lands as places where chaos is normal serves to build acceptance on the part of the American people when the Pentagon and CIA are the impetus of the coup d'états and the chaos that follows. Today, people line the streets in Bolivia, Hong Kong, Syria, Lebanon, Chile, Venezuela, and Paris. To name all the cities and countries embroiled in protest and revolution today would almost be a list of the UN's member nations. The U.S. has been deeply involved in many of these nations and is affecting much of the strife. For years, the State Department worked to oust Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. When Chavez died of a mysterious cancer in 2013, Nicolas Maduro, a former bus driver, trade union leader, Chavez appointee, and leader of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela rose to the position of president and then won a general election shortly thereafter. Protesting Maduro's latest inauguration in January 2019, Juan Guaido declared himself the acting president of Venezuela. Minutes later, the U.S. recognized Guaido as the rightful president. Due diligence should take more than minutes, unless the action was predetermined and preplanned. In Bolivia, a U.S.-backed coup has led to the ouster of populist President Evo Morales, as well as other top government officials. Trump stated that the coup has been a significant moment for democracy in the Western Hemisphere and hinted that Nicaragua was next. The media, by way of the Washington Post and the New York Times, also praised the coup, though never using the word, and claimed it was merely a matter of coincidence that it was the military that drove out Morales. In 1 week, the U.S.-supported new government of Bolivia has given the military a formal license to kill protesters, appeared on TV with a list of journalists who are to be rounded up, expelled hundreds of Cuban doctors, and conducted a massacre in Cochabamba. Is Bolivia now safe for democracy? Dollar diplomacy used to be taught in schools as a mere take on foreign policy. What's good for GM is good for America? That was before Twitter allowed us to see what was really happening as these coups progressed. Foreign policy isn't a card game, it's a war, or a continuous series of wars. Nothing is being made safe for democracy. The U.S. is actively engaged in a globe full of regime changes, all to make the world safe for corporatism. Another deranged neo-Bolshevik is punished for violent attacks. By John Friend, a radical leftist protester has pleaded guilty to violently striking another man in the face with a PVC pipe during an August 2018 anti-ICE protest in downtown Portland, or near its historic city hall. William Pierce, now 34, pleaded guilty last month to a second-degree assault charge stemming from the violent encounter, and is facing a 3-year jail sentence, minus time served, according to local reports. Pierce and several other radical left-wing protesters had set up a makeshift camp outside City Hall in the summer of 2018 in order to protest ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which has drawn the ire of radical leftist protesters across the country. Tim Schmitz, a 60-year-old Portland resident, was walking on the sidewalk near the encampment when he encountered Pierce and other protesters. In court testimony, Schmitz stated that the protesters had blocked the sidewalk and refused to let him pass. Schmitz also testified that Pierce and his associates had verbally accosted him, threatening him and his family. Schmitz eventually used his cane to clear a path on the sidewalk so he could make his way to his vehicle, which was parked nearby. Pierce followed Schmitz to his vehicle and attacked him with a PVC pipe that was used to display an abolish ICE flag after Schmitz had pulled out of the parking space and stopped at a red light. Pierce rammed the PVC pipe through Schmitz's open window, eventually striking him in the face, injuring his face and eye. "He started coming at me through the window and started spearing me with the flagpole," Schmitz told Fox 12, the local Fox affiliate based in Portland. "Shortly after the attack, I ducked it 6 or 8 times, and he finally got me the one time." Pierce was shortly thereafter arrested and spent 34 days in jail, which will factor into his final sentencing. "I'm really disgusted with Portland," Schmitz stated after the assault. "I'm disgusted and I feel ashamed that I even call it my birthplace. I know all about protesting and I understand it. I agree with it. I don't agree with stepping on my rights to do it, though, especially because you don't like what I say." Schmitz suffered lacerations to his face and eye socket as a result of the unprovoked assault. Pierce's successful prosecution and sentencing comes on the heels of at least 2 other violent left-wing radicals being brought to justice for their unprovoked violent assaults on their perceived political opponents. This newspaper reported in a previous edition on the prosecution of Gage Halapowski, a 24-year-old Antifa activist based in Portland, who was arrested and charged with striking a conservative activist in the head with a baton during a rally in June of this year. Additionally, David Campbell, a radical anti-Trump activist, was convicted on 2 counts of felony assault last month for attacking a Trump supporter in New York City following an event celebrating Trump's presidency. Local prosecutors in both Portland and New York should be commended for enforcing the law and prosecuting those engaging in political violence, which has increased dramatically following President Trump's entrance onto the political stage in the summer of 2015 when he initially announced his presidential candidacy. The radical left has used violence, terrorism, intimidation, and threats to target their political opponents and undermine the rule of law for far too long. Despite the claims of critics, border walls are being built. By Mark Anderson, Donna, Texas. "It's been a long time since a section of border wall has been built where no wall stood before, but here, just south of the city of Donna, Texas, in Hidalgo County near this writer's winter stomping grounds, it's actually happening, and it represents the most tangible sign to date that President Donald Trump is trying to keep his promise to briskly build new border barriers and not just modify or replace existing ones." The Rio Grande Valley, RGV, consists of 4 counties, Hidalgo and Cameron to the east, Starr to the west, and Willacy just north of the others. The RGV's border with Mexico stretches from the Gulf of Mexico west to the Falcon Dam, about 277 river miles. However, in the Border Patrol's Rio Grande Valley sector, just under 60 of these miles have a physical barrier. The new wall in the vicinity of Donna will begin filling that gap and will be connected to an existing border wall built in 2008 under the 2006 Secure Fence Act. On September 29, Customs and Border Protection, CPB, awarded a contract to Gibraltar-Cadell Joint Venture for up to $296 million to build 22 miles of non-contiguous border wall, starting just east of the Santa Ana Wildlife Refuge. Steel bollards, reportedly ranging in height from 18 to 30 feet, are to fill in the gaps of the existing wall. The contract was awarded in partnership with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. According to CPB news releases, in fiscal year 2019, October 1, 2018 through September 30 of 2019, Congress appropriated $1.375 billion for a South Texas border wall. However, the Santa Ana Wildlife Refuge and a few other RGV sites were exempted from having the border wall cut through them, including the La Lomita Catholic Chapel, the Benson Rio Grande Valley State Park, and the National Butterfly Center next door to the park, all of which are on the westerly side of the RGV sector. While National Butterfly Center Executive Director Mariana Trevino Wright told this writer that she protested the wall to prevent the project from disrupting the fragile vegetation that provides habitat for butterflies and bees right when the populations of these important pollinators appear to be dropping, an understandable position given the importance of pollinators to human food supplies and the general ecosystem, the National Wildlife Refuge is a different matter. That's because it has also been described by CBP officials and citizen border watchers as a human refuge where illegal entrants, including those involved in serious crimes and criminal enterprises, can hide with relative impunity because the refuge's strict regulations severely limit the ability of Border Patrol agents to enter the area while armed and apprehend the illegal aliens. As Trump stated during his recent well-attended rallies in Louisiana, Texas, and elsewhere, it's not altogether necessary to build a continuous, unbroken barrier for the entire 1,900-mile border that runs from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Coast in California. But the big-box media, in its effort to make the border barrier project seem insurmountably huge, tends to ignore or downplay Trump's explanation that border wall sections need not be built where mountains and other natural barriers suffice in stopping or slowing the traffickers of humans, guns, drugs, etc., while drones and Border Patrol personnel keep a close watch to nab those who might make it through. The always Trump-bashing, open borders-loving New York Times sent three reporters to Hidalgo County, writing about the entire southern border, while subtly admitting Trump is making real progress in Donna and beyond. The intrepid trio noted, there are hundreds more miles to go. The government has been racing to meet a deadline. The president's promise to build approximately 500 miles of border fencing by the end of 2020, according to Customs and Border Protection officials. About $9.8 billion has been set aside in funding from the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security and the Treasury Department Asset Forfeiture Fund. All told, about 76 miles of replacement wall have been completed along the border, federal officials said, meaning that more than 400 miles must be installed in about 60 weeks to meet the deadline. We think we can get it close to 500 miles by the end of next year, depending on certain terrain conditions, Trump was quoted as saying by the Times, referring to a September press conference when he showed off the steel bollards erected near San Diego. Trump added, "We're building at a breakneck speed." Trump's increased border security means fewer child traffickers. Better border security deters criminal activity of all kinds. By Mark Anderson, the Democrats and their ideological kin throughout most of the big box media get their kicks peddling old stats for new arguments. A recent case in point, activist Manfred Novick at a November 19 United Nations press conference stated that the U.S. still has more than 100,000 children in migration-related detention, which was retailed by most media without verification, save for agents France Presse and the Associated Press later issuing retractions. Why the retractions? Now Axe figures were from the days of the administration of Barack Obama, whose professions of supposed solidarity with, and sympathy for, illegal immigrants, especially immigrant children, allegedly knew no bounds. However, according to American Immigration Council attorney Aaron Reichlin Melnick, currently, there are, around, 1,500 kids in family detention, plus, around, 5,000 kids in, Office of Refugee Resettlement, shelters, but beyond such now, routine misrepresentation of the realities of the border crisis by those cursing President Donald Trump every nanosecond, the difficult but often effective work of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, goes on daily with little in the way of extensive recognition of the tangible results of such brave efforts. The fact of the matter is, while there are relatively few children being detained, more and more criminals, the ones that actually traffic the kids, are being arrested, and even while the Trump administration, contrary to the claims or the wishes of certain critics from both parties, is actually building new border wall sections as briskly as humanly possible, ICE announced the following on November 14 in a news release from ICE's Seattle office. In fiscal year 2019, October 1, 2018 to September 30, 2019, she, Homeland Security Investigations of ICE, initiated 4,224 child exploitation cases resulting in 3,771 criminal arrests, and identified or rescued 1,066 victims, an increase of nearly 18% over FY18, reflecting she's firm commitment to ending these heinous crimes against children, wherever they occur. What's especially noteworthy is the fact that poorly regulated immigration with porous borders results in crimes that fan out across the nation with global ramifications, an important consideration given the constant efforts by open border advocates who want everyone to believe that weak border security mainly affects the southern border states. As an ICE statement from the same news release explained, over the years, she's child exploitation prevention efforts morphed from a small center in Fairfax, VA into a worldwide initiative that includes agents across she's Seattle's area of responsibility, which spans Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. One of these major prevention efforts was the launch of she's flagship initiative, Operation Predator, and key domestic and foreign partnerships, which have been paramount in the expansion of both its reach and success. At a November 14 ribbon cutting to christen she's new Angel Watch Center in Fairfax, Acting ICE Director Matthew Albans remarked, "ICE analysts, investigators, and special agents possess unique law enforcement authorities concerning cross-border criminal activity and have long-standing jurisdiction to investigate traveling sex offenders." Albans also explained that the Angel Watch Center's primary task is to provide notification to foreign countries regarding the anticipated travel of convicted and registered child sex offenders. The center, which is an addition to the Cybercrime Center, enhances ICE agents' ability to safeguard innocent children from falling victim to dangerous predators. All told, this is what America needs to see: new border wall sections going up, arrests of cross-border child traffickers up, and detentions of minors relatively low. One real bombshell did explode at the impeachment hearings by Dr. Ron Paul. The most shocking thing about the House impeachment hearings to this point is not a smoking gun witness providing irrefutable evidence of quid pro quo. It's not that President Donald Trump may or may not have asked the Ukrainians to look into business deals between then Vice President Joe Biden's son and a Ukrainian oligarch. The most shocking thing to come out of the hearings thus far is confirmation that no matter who is elected President of the United States, the permanent government will not allow a change in our aggressive interventionist foreign policy, particularly when it comes to Russia. Even more shocking is that neither Republicans nor Democrats are bothered in the slightest. Take Lieutenant Col. Alexander Vindman, who earned high praise in the mainstream media. He did not come forth with first-hand evidence that Trump had committed any high crimes or misdemeanors. He brought a complaint against the president because he was worried that Trump was shifting U.S. policy away from providing offensive weapons to the Ukrainian government. He didn't think the president had the right to suspend aid to Ukraine because he supported providing aid to Ukraine. According to his testimony, Vindman was concerned over influencers promoting a false narrative of Ukraine inconsistent with the consensus views of the interagency. Consensus views of the interagency is another word for deep state, Vindman continued. While my interagency colleagues and I were becoming increasingly optimistic on Ukraine's prospects, this alternative narrative undermined U.S. government efforts to expand cooperation with Ukraine. Let that sink in for a moment. Vindman did not witness any crimes. He just didn't think the elected president of the United States had any right to change U.S. policy toward Ukraine or Russia. Likewise, his boss on the National Security Council staff, Fiona Hill, sounded more like she had just stepped out of the 1950s with her heated Cold War rhetoric, citing the controversial 2017 intelligence community assessment put together by then CIA Director John Brennan's handpicked analysts. She asserted that President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, and who gets to decide U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe? Not the president, according to government bureaucrat Hill. In fact, Hill told Congress, if the president, or anyone else, impedes or subverts the national security of the United States in order to further domestic political or personal interests, that is more than worthy of your attention. Who was Hill's boss? Former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who no doubt agreed that the president has no right to change U.S. foreign policy. Bolton's the one who explained that when Trump said U.S. troops would come home, it actually meant troops would stay put. One by one, the parade of witnesses before House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff sang from the same songbook. As U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland put it, in July and August 2019, we learned that the White House had also suspended security aid to Ukraine. I was adamantly opposed to any suspension of aid, as the Ukrainians needed those funds to fight against Russian aggression. Meanwhile, both Democrats and Republicans in large majority voted to continue spying on the rest of us by extending the unpatriotic Patriot Act. Authoritarianism is the real bipartisan philosophy in Washington, making mincemeat out of Adam Schiff. Young NY legislator exposes idiocy of narcissist leading impeachment effort, by Donald Jeffries. While Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has garnered nonstop, fawning coverage in the mainstream media, another young female New York legislator is quietly proving to be her antithesis. Rep. Elise Stefanik told the New York Post, I am proudly the opposite of AOC. During the recent Democratic Party impeachment hearings, run by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Rep. Adam Schiff, Stefanik boldly pointed out that Schiff hadn't always been opposed to the CIA whistleblower against Trump testifying. In late September of this year, Schiff declared that the whistleblower would be testifying before the committee very soon. Schiff went on to tell ABC's This Week that whistleblower will be allowed to come in without a minder from the Justice Department or from the White House to tell the whistleblower what they can and cannot say. We'll get the unfiltered testimony. Stefanik read these and other past statements of Schiff's into the record during a recent hearing, and directly accused the chairman of duplicity and abuse of power. Stefanik, in contrast to the glowing praise AOC has received from our state-controlled media, was called a perfect example of why just electing someone because they're a woman or a millennial doesn't necessarily get you the leaders we need. By ABC News chief political analyst Matthew Dowd on Twitter. Dowd subsequently apologized and deleted the post. Stefan, Ike, not backing down, declared, were this something that were lobbed against a Democratic person, this person would have had to resign. ABC should issue an apology on his behalf, and they should strongly consider taking action because he is their chief political correspondent, and it is outrageous and shameful. Conservative critics blasted the tweet as sexist. Adam Schiff was adamant about the whistleblower testifying, and Speaker Pelosi said she supported the whistleblower testifying. They only changed that statement when it became clear there was coordination with the whistleblower and Adam Schiff's staffers, Stefanik added to the post. I was the first member to ask, when did Adam Schiff have access to the whistleblower? It's a big deal because before this person was a whistleblower, they were coordinating with Democratic staff members who turned them into a whistleblower and advised them about the process. The political rollout and communications rollout were just so orchestrated. Stefanik has jested with Schiff frequently during the impeachment investigation. She objected vehemently to Schiff's attempt to prevent her from questioning former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch, after ranking member Devin Nunes yielded his time to her. Adam Schiff is making up the rules as he goes, Stefanik declared. It is quite clear that Adam Schiff does not like hearing the facts when I lay them out, but that's his problem, not mine. The establishment left struggled to excuse Schiff's treatment of Stefanik, best exemplified by a headline in the Washington Post headed, Was Schiff Sexist, or Was Elise Stefanik Out of Order? Stefanik tweeted, since I've exposed Adam Schiff and his regime of secrecy in front of millions of Americans, far-left socialist Democrats, like my opponent, are attacking me. They will stop at nothing to impeach Donald Trump. Donate today to help us fight back. The mainstream media, usually overtly smitten with strong and outspoken women, in this case supported Schiff over Stefanik. Stefanik also scored points with her questioning of Yovanovitch, getting her to admit that the defensive lethal aid she'd been pushing for was provided not by the Obama administration, but by the Trump administration. Ironically, Democrats reacted quite differently when a different chairman, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, squelched remarks from another female legislator, Senator Elizabeth Warren, during a 2017 Senate hearing. McConnell admonished Warren for breaking Senate rules, and his remark that nevertheless, she persisted, became a still popular Democratic slogan, with the Washington Post proclaiming it to be a battle cry. The Post would call Stefanik's battle with Schiff transparently manufactured in a gender-centric stunt, until Ocasio-Cortez's election. Stefanik was the youngest female congressional representative in history, when she took office at age 30 in 2014. Emphasizing the Alice in Wonderland nature of present-day American politics, one of Stefanik's harshest critics is George Conway, husband of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign manager Kelly, and Conway, openly attacking her. George Conway recently tweeted, "At Elise Stefanik is lying trash, please give to her opponent, at Tedra Cobb." Conway himself gave $2,800 to Cobb's campaign. The always feisty Stefanik replied on Twitter, "And for you at Conway 3D, the one thing I've never been called in my life is trash. You need serious help. My opponent Tax and Tedra can have your sick misogynist support." Conway, like many liberals, was triggered by Stefanik's war of words with Adam Schiff, accusing her of gaslighting. Lost in these theatrics is the continuing charade that is the impeachment investigation led by Schiff, primarily based on Trump's attempt to expose the Biden family's corruption. Deep state tries to break Stone. Clearly partisan Obama judge could give Trump a lie decades behind bars. By Donald Jeffries. The deep state's promulgation of the absurd and thoroughly discredited Russian collusion theory has claimed another victim. Former Trump aide and friend Roger Stone was convicted on 7 counts of obstruction, witness tampering, and making false statements. The 24-page indictment against him rivaled the Warren Report for surrealism. There is a mention, for instance, of Stone threatening a dog. Michael Barnett, chairman of the Palm Beach County Republican Party, spoke for many when he said, "Roger Stone is a friend of ours. We appreciate his service to the president. We believe he's a real patriot. We also believe that he was railroaded and this conviction is not fair. This whole Russian collusion investigation was a sham and this conviction stems from an initial investigation that was not based in merit. We hope he appeals. We hope that justice will eventually prevail for Roger," a deluded Florida Democratic Party chair Terry Rizzo countered. 5 of Trump's lieutenants, Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, and now Roger Stone, have all pleaded guilty or have been convicted of a crime. The stench of corruption is all around Donald Trump, and today's ruling reminds us just how important and needed Congress's impeachment inquiry is. It has not been lost on many supporters still clamoring for Trump to fulfill his campaign promise to drain the swamp that so many of his loyal supporters have been convicted on laughable charges, while not a single deep state criminal has even been prosecuted. Despite the continuing false mantra that Russians hacked Democratic National Committee, DNC, emails and WikiLeaks released them in order to damage Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, the facts suggest otherwise. Julian Assange, who remains in exile and in failing health, has all but named former DNC staffer Seth Rich as the individual who leaked the emails and was subsequently the victim of an unsolved murder that no one, including his family, is interested in investigating. None of our state-controlled media has had the slightest interest in the overt corruption those DNC emails revealed. That is, an open plan to steal the nomination from voter favorite Bernie Sanders and hand the nomination to Queen of Corruption Hillary Clinton. Just the mention of Rich's name now brings the condemnation of every establishment liberal. Incredibly, Stone faces the prospect of decades in prison for these invented crimes, the prosecutions and possible prosecutions of figures like Manafort, Flynn, Bannon, and Jerome Carsey are all tethered to the Russiagate fairy tale, The emptiness of the Mueller report appears not to have stopped these persecutions of Trump loyalists, as our injustice system is revealing itself to the world as thoroughly corrupted, filled with politicized judges, prosecutors, and juries intent on criminalizing their ideological opponents. While Stone may be serving hard time for potential email contact with heroic whistleblower Assange, Hillary Clinton, who admitted to disposing of 33,000 emails and having the FBI destroy a laptop with a hammer, remains free at large. While a federal jury has found Stone guilty of lying to Congress, members of Congress themselves cannot be prosecuted for lying on the floor of the House or the Senate. The Constitution provides our representatives with immunity from lawsuits or criminal prosecution for anything they say during speeches or debates. This protection extends to committee reports and resolutions. Stone has been treated like a serial killer, beginning with the pre-dawn FBI raid on his home this past February. The judge overseeing the prosecution, Amy Berman Jackson, was a typically partisan appointee of Barack Obama. Early on, she hit Stone with a gag order and threatened to jail him. Berman was previously assigned to Mueller's ridiculous hacking case against 12 Russians. Berman also presided over the Manafort hearing, bluntly telling him that she determined he had intentionally lied. She refused to allow Stone's defense to show the Russian collusion nonsense for what it was. Her record of judicial activism is clear, and her lifelong appointment to the federal bench assures that anyone with the pedigree of a Stone will not be treated fairly in her courtroom. A caveat here, this author is tangentially associated with Stone, by virtue of him writing the foreword to the paperback edition of Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. He was very supportive of that work, and during one phone conversation stated, "Trump knows about all the conspiracies. You would love him. If there is the least bit of sincerity behind all his rhetoric, Trump will pardon Stone." Stone was loyal to a fault to Trump, even as the president ignored or broke one campaign promise after another. That is the only chance Stone has. He certainly can't trust our rigged legal system to provide justice. Famed filmmaker at JFK Confab, Oliver Stone meets with woman who says she has inside info on Oswald. By St. Patrick, the JFK assassination research community has for years held multiple conferences in Dallas during the week of the November 22nd anniversary. The dueling conferences are often like oil and water, as the Kennedy assassination research community is, like most alternative history communities, irreparably fractured. While there were some political maneuverings for speakers in the months leading up to the conferences, no one expected the olive branch to be extended by the weekend's most notable guest. Oliver Stone is the director of the 1991 movie JFK, which starred Kevin Costner as New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison and which was nominated for multiple Oscars. In 2020, Stone will release a new multi-part documentary based largely upon author James D. Eugenio's Destiny Betrayed, JFK, Cuba, and the Garrison Case. There are reasons why Stone would want to capture the totality of his chief demographic, rather than just half of it. He was already scheduled to speak at the Saturday evening banquet at the conference sponsored by Citizens Against Political Assassinations, CAPA. The surprise came on Saturday afternoon when Stone made an unannounced visit to the rival conference hosted by Judith Vere Baker. Baker in her story, like that of self-professed grassy knoll shooter James Files and the topic of Zapruder film alteration, have been lightning rods within the JFK research community. In her book Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, Baker describes an affair she claims she had with alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald in the summer of 1963. She and Oswald were both in New Orleans at the time, and both were married. It is a complex story that involves potential conspirator David Ferry, Dr. Alton Oxner, via weapons, and the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman. The story has been divisive within the community. While many lay people believe her, the research community has largely opposed the validity of her story. Those who were scheduled to speak alongside Stone at the CAPA conference have uniformly opposed Baker as a legitimate witness in the case. Stone arrived unannounced at Baker's 7th annual assassination conference late Saturday afternoon. Stone and Baker engaged in a lengthy conversation in the hallway outside the conference hall as crowds quickly gathered. This writer was in attendance and in the hallway as the scene unfolded. Stone and Baker sat in chairs as Baker laid out her evidence. Stone was attentive and followed, asking periodic questions. At the end, they stood and embraced. Stone said, "I believe you." This moment brought instant elation throughout Baker's conference. As word spread to those who disbelieved Baker, perplexed speculation began. Why had Stone done this? Was it just publicity for his upcoming documentary? Did he simply realize he needed that audience back? Whatever the reason, within the JFK assassination research community, this impromptu moment will long be remembered as a big deal. In other conference news, Massachusetts researcher Edgar F. Tatro was given the Etcheri Award for his valuable contributions to researchers of the case. Tatro has covered the case for over 50 years, has taught classes on the assassination, and was the only researcher present in court when Garrison tried alleged conspirator Clay Shaw in a New Orleans courtroom in 1967. Fellow researchers often use the word encyclopedic to describe Tatro, who has a superhuman grasp on the characters, events, and personal links within the entire scope and spectrum of the case and its research history. The Kappa Conference featured DiEugenio, CIA expert Jefferson Morley, Dr. Cyril Wecht, Dr. Gary Aguilar, Bill Kelly, Bill Simpich, and Dr. John Newman. The featured speakers at Baker's conference included Tatro, Professor David Denton, Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, David Knight, Secret Service expert Vince Palamara, Robert Groden, Grover Proctor, Dick Russell, Mal Hyman, and Edward T. Haslam in his final conference appearance. It has been 56 years since John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas's Dealey Plaza. Those who still research the case are growing older and calling upon a new generation of Americans to whom those torches may be passed. It's important to get this information into schools, to inspire the next generation, yet the annual conferences remain vital to the spirits of those same researchers. Many of them research alone, the only one in their circle of friends and families to do so, and often with some ridicule attached. There are a number of Kennedy widows, a phrase used within the community to describe the men and women who have been left by spouses in large part to add to the time, fervency, and dedication devoted to this research. Yet there are happy endings. Researcher Robert Groden, 74, whose birthday is on the assassination day, November 22, recently married a woman who has been involved in the research community for years. Groden, the man most responsible for the American public seeing the Zapruder film for the first time in 1975, and his new wife were married on the grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza and celebrated their wedding reception at Camp Easy's, the local Dallas restaurant that was a favorite of Oswald assassin Jack Ruby and others connected to organized crime. If former Kennedy widows can find second chances, the community remains hopeful that this research can find newly inspired generations to continue seeking the justice that is so rightly deserved. Author exposes unholy tryst between journalists and CIA, by Dr. Kevin Barrett. Is mainstream journalism mostly fake news, as President Trump says? If so, why? How does the system impede real journalism and promote propaganda on behalf of warmongers and financial elites? Anyone searching for an accurate, detailed, grimly entertaining answer to those questions should consult Udo Ulfkit's Prestitutes, embedded in the pay of the CIA. Ulfkit, a leading German mainstream journalist himself, quit in 2003 and became a whistleblower, author, and independent journalist. He published Prestitutes in 2014 but died suspiciously in 2017 before the book could be brought out in English. Overcoming odd obstacles, Progressive Press finally published an English edition in October 2019. Publisher John Paul Leonard explained on my radio show, "There was a concern that the book had been privished, which is a kind of neologism meaning keep it private instead of publishing it." It had been a top 10 bestseller for a year or so in Germany. The publisher, Kopp Verlag, sold the rights to some incredibly obscure publisher that had done maybe one book that didn't sell any copies. I don't know how that happened. The general perception was that this was an inside job by the CIA to suppress the book in the American and English-speaking world. This so-called publisher, Tan Lane, had it on Amazon saying they were going to put it out, but they kept postponing it and it never came out, and then an incredible thing happened. There was so much interest in this book that it got 24 five-star reviews on Amazon from people who wanted to read it. Go to www.patreon.com/posts/314304046 to listen to my one-hour interview with Prestitutes publisher John Leonard and translator Andrew Skladman. It's easy to see why someone didn't want Prestitutes to come out in English, though his main target is the German media. Ulfkett implicates the imperial USA, and its elite governmental and non-governmental organizations, in most of the corruption he describes. Obviously, the US media, with its even greater proximity to Washington and Wall Street, is equally corrupt, if not more so. The mainstream media, MSM, tells us that anyone who doubts its reports about violent events is a crazy conspiracy theorist, yet as Ulfkett reveals, war correspondents in the many war zones he visited habitually fake their footage. MSM war correspondents spend most of their time at the bar in their safe five-star hotel. When they need footage, they drive out to the desert with a camera and a bunch of gasoline cans, in search of an abandoned wreck near the highway to set ablaze. Then they film themselves dancing, ducking, and gesticulating in front of the burning hulk. They send the video to their networks, which had sound effects of gunfire and explosions. In the rare case that a war correspondent uncovers a real, important, true story, it is usually suppressed. That's what happened during the 1980s Iraqi invasion of Iran, when in July 1988 Ulfkett permanently damaged his health to get horrific images of Iranian victims of the chemical weapons that Germany, acting under U.S. orders, had sold to Saddam Hussein. Ulfkett's pictures show the victims' brains flowing out of their mouths, eyes, and noses. His detailed report on this, potentially one of the biggest global stories of the 1980s, was suppressed by his bosses at the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, a leading German MSM outlet that fronts for the U.S. Empire and the Bilderberger Trilateral CFR elites who run it. Ulfkett says MSM journalists understand that elite sex crimes and depravity must not be reported. Certain things shouldn't be made public. While doing a story on the German underworld's most notorious pimp, Stefan Jacob, Ulfkett learned that global elite members, including the head of the CIA's Berlin office, were implicated in all sort of depravity, including a playground on the Fliegerstrasse in Berlin where the men back then could allegedly drive by slowly to pick out children for free delivery to their place for sex. If only Americans could be forced to see what their hard, earned tax dollars are paying for. Today, more and more people are taking the red pill and learning that we are ruled by a globalist elite of depraved psychopaths whose crimes are facilitated and enabled by the lies of the fake news media. The popular catchphrase "Jeffrey Epstein didn't commit suicide, like 9/11 was an inside job 15 years ago," has gone viral, providing evidence that the world is waking up to who really rules us and how. But knowing that the MSM is lying, and proving it in excruciating detail, are two different things. If and when the people finally rise up and overthrow the psychopathic elite, the late whistleblowing journalist Udo Ulfkett will deserve a share of the credit. H. Udo Ulfkett's book Prestitutes, Embedded in the Pay of the CIA, soft cover, 256 pages, $25 plus $4 S&H in the US, is available from AFP, 117 LaGrange Avenue, La Plata, Doctor of Medicine 20646. Call 1-888-699-NEWS toll free to charge. Mon, Thursday, September 5th ET. The Fraud of Anti-Semitism Exposed, by Phil Giraldi Newspeak, was the expression coined in George Orwell's novel 1984 to describe the ambiguous or deliberately misleading use of language to make political propaganda and narrow the thought options of those who are on the receiving end. In the context of today's political discourse, or what passes for the same, it would be interesting to know what George would think of the saturation use of anti-Semitism as something like a tactical discussion stopper, employed to end all dispute while also condemning those accused of the crime as somehow outside the pale, Monsters who are consigned forever to derision and obscurity, the Israelis and, to be sure, many diaspora Jews know exactly how the expression has been weaponized. Former Israeli Minister Shulamit Aloni explained how it is done. Anti-Semitic, it's a trick, we always use it. Indeed, a claim of anti-Semitism even crept into the current impeachment inquiry in Washington, where Rep. Raja Krishnamoorthy, Dil, questioned National Security Council member Fiona Hill about suggestions from conspiracy theorists that Hill herself as well as former ambassador to Ukraine Marie Ivanovich have been linked to George Soros, and that Lieutenant Col. Alexander Weinman, a Ukrainian Jew, might not be completely loyal to the United States. Krishnamoorthy asked, would you say that these different theories, these conspiracy theories targeting you, spun in part by people like Roger Stone, as well as fueled by Rudy Giuliani and others, basically have a tinge of anti-Semitism to them, at least, Hill answered. Well, certainly when they involve George Soros, they do. Krishnamoorthy, who is seeking a career in politics, understands that pandering to Jewish power in America is essential, so his question was more an expression of where his own loyalty lies than serious. And his query is rooted in what appears in the U.S. mainstream media, reflective as it nearly always is of a certain institutional Jewish viewpoint. One would think from the New York Times and Washington Post that there has been a dramatic increase in anti-Semitism worldwide, but that claim is largely a fabrication that is being exploited to support making any criticism of Israel and Jewish group behavior a hate crime. What has been taking place is not hatred of Jews but rather a rejection of how Israel and major Jewish organizations behave. Foremost is the undeniable fact that Israel has been acting particularly badly, even by its admittedly low standards. Its weekly slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza has been unusually observable in spite of media attempts to avoid mentioning it. Plus its frequent attacks on Syria and demands for war against Iran have also raised questions about the intentions of whatever kleptocratic regime emerges in Tel Aviv in the near future. That all means that the perception of Israel, which boasts that it is the exclusively Jewish state composed of people chosen by God, inevitably raises questions about the international Jewish community that provides much of its support. But it is important to understand that the hostility towards Zionism as a political movement is mostly driven by Israeli behavior, not by Jews as an ethnicity or as a religion. The alleged increase in anti-Semitic incidents is largely fueled by how those incidents are defined. Israel and its friends have worked hard to broaden the parameters of the discussion, making any criticism of Israel or its activities ipso facto an anti-Semitic incident. The State Department's working definition of anti-Semitism includes the targeting of the State of Israel and it warns that anti-Semitism is a criminal offense. Recent legislation in Washington and also in Europe has criminalized hitherto legal and nonviolent efforts to pressure Israel regarding its inhumanity vis-à-vis the Palestinians. Legitimate criticism of Israel thereby becomes both anti-Semitism and criminal, increasing the count of so-called anti-Semitic incidents. That means that the numbers inevitably go up, providing fodder to validate a repressive response. One might add that Hollywood, the mainstream media, and academia have contributed to the allegations regarding surging anti-Semitism, relentlessly unleashing a torrent of material rooting out alleged anti-Semites, while simultaneously heaping praise on Israel and its achievements. Professor of Holocaust Studies Deborah Lipstadt has written a book Anti-Semitism, Here and Now about what she regards as the new anti-Semitism, supporting her belief that it is getting markedly worse in both Europe and the US. There is also a movie about her confrontation with Holocaust critic David Irving called Denial. All of the media exposure of so-called anti-Semitism has a political objective, whether intended or not, which is to insulate Israel itself from any criticism and to create for all Jews the status of perpetual victimhood which permits many in the diaspora to unflinchingly support a foreign country against the interests of the nations where they were born, raised, and made their fortunes. That is called dual loyalty and, in spite of frequent denials from Israel apologists, it clearly exists for many American Jews, who are passionate about the Jewish state, including members of the Trump administration Avi Berkovitz, David Friedman, and Jared Kushner. Much of the recent activity to silence critics of Israel has, ironically, taken place on university campuses, where free speech has been revoked because some Jewish students have claimed to be threatened by criticism of the Jewish state. The growing nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, BDS, on campus is rightly perceived as a major threat by both the Israeli government and the Israel lobby in the United States. 27 states and Congress have either passed or intend to vote on legislation penalizing its supporters. To combat the BDS movement, a recent document entitled A Hotbed for Hate, a comprehensive dossier of antisemitism at Columbia University and Barnard College since the 2016-2017 academic year has been published by a Jewish group in New York City that calls itself Alums for Campus Fairness. It claims to be a meticulous documentation of antisemitism in action at the two colleges, but when one goes through the entire 33 pages, nearly all the citations relate to protests, speeches, or writing concerning Israel and its inhumane treatment of the Palestinians. The campaign to eliminate any criticism of Israel or the standard narratives that support the creation of the Jewish state is indeed unrelenting, and where the claim of antisemitism is not enough, allegations of Holocaust denial become the ultimate weapons. Karen Pollack of the Holocaust Education Trust said in January, "One person questioning the truth of the Holocaust is one too many. That is nonsense. Any, and all, historical events should be questioned regularly," a principle that is particularly true regarding developments that carry a lot of emotional baggage. The Israel lobby would have all Americans believe that any criticism of Israel is motivated by historic hatred of Jews and is therefore anti-Semitism. Don't believe it. When the AIPAC crowd screams that linking Jews and money is a classic anti-Semitic trope, respond by pointing out that Jews and money are very much in play in the corruption of Congress and the media over Israel. Terrible things are being done in the Middle East in the name of Jews and of Israel, who make the war criminals appear to be victims every time they raise the issue of anti-Semitism. Just recall what the Israeli minister admitted: "It's a trick. We always use it. The swamp never rats on itself. Don't expect any high-level crooks to be named in Justice Department." FISA report, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Former U.S. Attorney Jody Genova predicts that Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report on the Obama regime's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, court violations and U.S. Attorney John Durham's criminal investigation of the Russiagate hoax perpetrated by the CIA, FBI, Democratic National Committee, and prostitute media will be very bad for people in the Obama administration. It's going to be devastating. It's going to ruin careers. For the sake of accountable government, I hope that DeGenova is right, but I have my doubts. Cabinet departments and government agencies are not very good at investigating themselves. Attorney General William Barr's job is to protect his department. He knows, and will be often told, that to bring indictments against Justice Department officials would discredit the Justice Department in the public's mind. It would affect the attitude of juries toward prosecutions. Durham knows the same thing. He also knows that he will create a hostile environment for himself if he indicts Department of Justice, DOJ, officials, and that when he joins a law firm to capitalize on his experience as a U.S. attorney, he will not receive the usual favors when he represents clients against DOJ charges. Horowitz knows that his job is to cover up or minimize any illegalities in order to protect the DOJ from scandals. In Washington, cover-ups are the rule, and the DOJ cover-up might already have begun. One sign of a cover-up is to announce a future release date of the report. This has now occurred with Horowitz's report on the FISA violations. The purpose of such announcements is to allow the report to be discredited in advance and to be old news by the time it appears. Another sign of a cover-up is the use of leaks to shift the focus from high-level officials to lowly underlings, and this has happened with the Horowitz report, which has leaked that a low-level FBI attorney is under criminal investigation for allegedly falsifying a document related to the surveillance of former Trump campaign official Carter Page in 2016. According to the leak, the FBI attorney has acknowledged that he did alter the document. In other words, it seems we are being prepared for a false story that the plot against Trump originated in lower levels and not with CIA Director John Brennan. FBI Director James Comey, FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, and the rest. This is the way the cover-ups of the U.S. torture prison, Abu Ghraib, in Afghanistan was handled in the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Only the underlings take the hit as if they were in charge, acting on their own, independently of their superiors. Another sign that a cover-up is in place is Barr's assurance that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself and that evidence to the contrary is just a series of coincidences that, misunderstood, resulted in a conspiracy theory. Barr claims to have personally reviewed security footage that shows no one entered the area where Epstein was imprisoned. Previously we were told that the security cameras were not turned on, so what security footage did Barr review? Can the rest of us see the evidence? Barr also in his pronouncement evaded the remarks of a retired medical examiner, who stated clearly that the damage to Epstein's neck is not consistent with suicide but is associated with strangulation. There was no reason whatsoever for Epstein to kill himself. He had so much dirt on the Western political elite that he could not be given his day in open court, so he was murdered. The question is, why was he picked up and murdered? Was he using the pedophile information to exact blackmail payments from those he had provided with underage sex? Is it possible for an elite society to be more corrupt than the Western elite societies? How can the West survive when its elites are corrupt beyond comprehension? That Epstein did not kill himself is completely obvious. So when Barr covers up Epstein's murder, this is an indication that he will cover up the military security complex DNC prostitute coup against Trump. From what I know of Washington, I am certain that Washington, the cesspool of the world, will never rat on itself. Author alleges U.S. sports corrupt as anything else is that sporting event you are watching rigged. By Donald Jeffries. It's estimated that up to $150 billion is wagered illegally on sports every year in this country. Legally, in Nevada alone nearly $5 billion was bet in 2017. A 2019 study found that overall the sports betting industry is worth a mind-boggling $3 trillion. Older sports fans can easily recall some of the most shady sporting events. Muhammad Ali's invisible punch that knocked out Sonny Liston. Joe Namath's guarantee that the lowly New York Jets would upset the prohibitive favorite Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. Roberto Duran's strange no-mass rematch with Sugar Ray Leonard. The confession by former NBA referee Tim Donaghy that he regularly conspired to fix games. There are countless other examples. Building on widespread public skepticism, author Brian Tuohy wrote the provocative 2010 book The Fix Is In, The Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. Football and basketball games would be exceptionally easy to rig, considering the referee's ability to influence the results in those sports. Everyone associated with football acknowledges that holding, for instance, could be called on every play. And yet no one questions the arbitrary nature of the holding penalties that are called, and how they frequently negate huge offensive gains or touchdowns. The same can be said for defensive pass interference, which again could reasonably be flagged on every play. Those who rule the NFL and NCAA have invented nonsensical terms like incidental contact to explain penalties that aren't called, to the partisan fans of each team. The late NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle's admonition that any team can beat another on any given Sunday has long been touted to explain the most dubious upsets. In basketball, while basic rules are routinely overlooked, especially traveling infractions, one team may often get a huge advantage in free throw opportunities. This has long been especially noticeable in big NCAA conferences like the ACC. If one team gets 20 more free throw chances than their opponent, it will be pretty difficult for them not to win. Tim Donaghy was quickly marginalized and labeled an isolated bad egg when he revealed that NBA games have and can be easily fixed. It is another common trope that star players in the NBA get the calls. How that is supposed to fit into any kind of impartial and fair officiating is best left to the sports journalists to explain. In the 1990s, though it has literally been scrubbed from the record, then Washington Redskins wide receiver Irving Fryer confessed to having been paid off to drop key passes during the 1984 NCAA championship game. Friars Nebraska Cornhuskers were heavy favorites over Miami, who pulled off a huge upset. Not a single journalist was interested in the details of Friar's claims, which would have demonstrated how corrupt big-time college athletics are. No one asked who paid him off, or how much he received. Around the same time, Baltimore Colts defensive lineman Bubba Smith proclaimed, in his biography and in several interviews, that he and many of his teammates had always believed Super Bowl III had been set up for the Jets to win, in order to give the still-fledgling AFL legitimacy with the established NFL teams. Smith even claimed that Colts owner Carol Rosenblum bet against his own team. Rosenblum, who would sell the Colts and buy the Los Angeles Rams franchise, drowned under such suspicious circumstances that even PBS suggested the known gambler may have been murdered. As has been pointed out in recent years, the professional sports leagues don't guarantee that their games are legitimate and indeed advertise they are for entertainment purposes. The NCAA is corrupt to the core, from powerful alumni pouring untold amounts of money into boosting the chances of their alma mater's football and basketball teams, to the laughable claim that all of the players are students. Some years ago, former Washington Redskins defensive lineman Dexter Manley tearfully revealed that he was illiterate. Somehow, this didn't stop him from getting multiple scholarship offers from top universities and attending Oklahoma State. Georgetown University has some of the most stringent academic requirements in the world, yet Patrick Ewing was admitted and had to have a special tutor to instruct him in basic subjects. Allen Iverson was recruited right out of prison, after being pardoned by the Virginia governor. Throw in the fact the U.S. military was caught paying NFL teams to honor the troops a few years ago, and all the social justice warrior propaganda, especially during Breast Cancer Awareness Month when the players all wear pink. The off-field behavior of too many players, which nearly always goes unpunished, and you have anything but an honest product. The trillion-dollar world of sports is just another part of our country's massive corruption. Trade depression predicted by alarmists never happened. By Robert Romano, readers will recall that, during the 2016 election, financial and political analysts were tripping over themselves to predict that if President Donald Trump won and implemented his planned trade agenda, which included tariffs, we'd have a global recession perhaps even as bad as the Great Depression. Well, Trump went through with the tariffs on China, so where's the trade depression some were warning about? For example, one headline on CNBC in May 2016 blared, "Trump trade plans could cause global recession." Experts, that piece quoted Caroline Freund of the Peterson Institute for International Economics saying, "If you take Trump's position as real, that we would do this, then it would take the world down the road that we saw in the 1930s with the Smoot-Hawley tariff." Freund added, "The world would definitely fall into a recession, definitely. We're still waiting." The Washington Post's Robert Samuelson wrote in June 2018, "The ghost of Smoot-Hawley seems to haunt Trump." After Trump levied tariffs on steel and aluminum, with Samuelson warning, "By slowing economic growth, it darkens the outlook and reduces the ability of debtors to repay their lenders." So much for the lessons of history, so much for those lessons. In fact, instead of slowing economic growth, 2018, as it turns out, had the strongest economic growth since 2005 at 2.9%. Or maybe they were worried about China's economy more. Unemployment has now had a 50-year low at 3.5%, whereas in the Great Depression it hit a high of more than 25%. And now, with the first step of a free trade deal with Japan finalized with reciprocal tariff reductions on agriculture and digital trade, plus other deals with South Korea, Mexico, and Canada, bold predictions of an all-out trade war with the rest of the world have proven to be greatly exaggerated. Even on China, where trade talks continue, Trump has shown a willingness to negotiate for reciprocal tariff and non-tariff trade barrier reductions, including dealing with China's competitively devalued currency, the yuan, that is, critics allege the president was incapable of. Think on that aspect. If Trump were to succeed with a deal with China, that would still be closer to free trade than what the defenders of the status quo were advocating, which was to do nothing or to unilaterally eliminate tariffs. because then both sides would be lowering trade barriers instead of just one side. That is because the surest path to free trade has always been fair and reciprocal reductions of tariffs and non-tariff barriers. It is the only way to sustainably do it both economically and, more importantly, politically. The failure here on the part of the punditry might have simply to do with a lack of listening comprehension. All Trump was ever saying was that it was a bad idea to unilaterally give away something for free, that a better deal could be had, and that, as president, he would pursue better deals. As for the policymakers in Washington, D.C. and in other capitals, for years there was simply a failure to negotiate. Others would have preferred the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, multilateral deal to somehow lure China into a trade deal. Trump prefers the bilateral approach, and he is apt to use confrontation to get trade partners' attention. The idea that Beijing was desperate to get in on the TPP was always speculative when the U.S. was giving China access to our markets in return for almost nothing. Where the TPP globalist hoped something might happen in the future, Trump increased the ante. To bring Beijing to the table, Trump did indeed threaten tariffs, and he levied them. Now there are talks where once there were none. Whether they will ultimately succeed is another matter, but initiating the discussion in itself is a win. All of this is a far cry from the Great Depression, where, back then, we were a net exporter. Now we're a net importer that is looking for ways to expand U.S. producer access to foreign markets and to boost domestic production. The U.S. always had more to gain from Trump's tough trade stance, and China the most to lose, and with the trade deals with Japan, Canada, Mexico, and South Korea in the bag, plus a strong economy and a great labor market, it turns out Trump was right after all. Electoral College, voter ID targeted Soros, Arnolds, Rockefellers want elections rigged for the radical left, by Richard McCarthy. For years, Democrats have argued that they will soon have a permanent majority due to the country's demographic changes, but liberal billionaires, like George Soros and John and Laura Arnold, are not content to wait. To speed things along, they support left-wing organizations that constantly scheme to find ways to undermine the integrity of our elections and boost Democrats' chances of winning. To begin with, Soros and the Arnolds support the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and the Brennan Center for Justice. The ACLU has a long and sordid history of proudly defending the indefensible. These days, though, it brags that it has sued the Trump administration more than 100 times. The Brennan Center was founded by former clerks for liberal U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan. The center is now run by a senior official from the Clinton administration. In the early days of the Trump administration, the center was recognized as part of the resistance. Both the ACLU and the Brennan Center oppose voter ID laws. While these left-wing organizations do everything they can to make it easier to commit voter fraud, a 2016 Gallup poll shows just how out of touch they are on election integrity. Gallup found that 80% of voters support ID laws, including 95% of Republicans, 63% of Democrats, and 83% of independents. Furthermore, although the ACLU and the Brennan Center claim that voter ID laws disenfranchise minority voters, they disregard evidence that shows that these laws do not suppress minority voter turnout. In fact, 77% of minorities support voter ID laws. The ACLU also opposes efforts to clean up voter rolls that would reduce chances of vote fraud. Why is it that the ACLU is so desperate to ensure that voter rolls are filled with dead people and people registered in multiple states? Good government? Doubtful. What the ACLU refuses to recognize is that, while some effort to maintain the integrity of our elections might inconvenience some voters from time to time, the broader voting public has a right to expect that the government is taking reasonable steps to ensure that only those eligible to vote are allowed to do so. After all, no one in their right mind wants their vote cancelled out by a non-citizen or someone who votes twice. The Brennan Center says it supports early voting and same-day registration, but, despite its claims, there is very little justification for weeks of early voting. If a voter cannot find any time to vote on election day during the 12 or so hours that polls are open and cannot submit an absentee ballot, many would reasonably conclude that that voter is not sufficiently motivated to vote. In spite of liberal groups' advocacy for early voting, the evidence suggests early voting does not increase turnout, and could even result in lower turnout. Early voting does, however, increase work for county workers and volunteers as well as the cost to taxpayers. Soros and the Arnolds, along with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, support Fair Vote. Fair Vote is run by Rob Ritchie, a former campaign staffer for a liberal Democrat congresswoman. Fair Vote supports same-day registration and voting, automatic voter registration, and even allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to vote. All three of these organizations, the ACLU, the Brennan Center, and Fair Vote, support the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Under this scheme, states with 270 electoral votes would agree to cast their electoral votes for whichever candidate wins the popular vote regardless of whether that candidate actually won a state. Although a number of states have signed on to this, this end run around the Constitution may well be unconstitutional and could even spark a constitutional crisis. All of this proves why America needs more conservative donors and activists, as well as more cooperation between right-leaning organizations, to push back against these assaults on the integrity of our elections.